Yesterday, voters in 14 states faced new restrictions at the polls. Last year's Supreme Court ruling in the case of Shelby County versus Holder struck down part of the 1968 Voting Rights Act, making it easier for states to enact new voting restrictions like requiring voters to have a government-issued photo ID at the polls. Ari Berman, contributing writer for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute, has been working on a book about voting rights since 1965. Not been working on the book, but on voting rights since 1965. And he's been watching these new voting restrictions and the court battles over them. He joins us now to talk about them and how they affected yesterday's midterm elections. Hello and welcome back.
Thank you for having me back, Leonard.
The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1968 to prohibit racial discrimination in voting. Can you remind us what the Supreme Court ruling in Shelby County versus Holder changed?
Sure. So the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. And
65.
What it said, yeah. What it basically, it did a number of things, but what the Supreme Court struck down was this formula for covering states with the worst history of voting discrimination. Those states had to approve their voting changes with the federal government so that they wouldn't discriminate in the future. So states like Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, they had poll taxes, literacy tests for a very long time. When those things were struck down by the Voting Rights Act in 1965, the people that passed the Voting Rights Act wanted to make sure those states wouldn't replicate new voting restrictions going forward. So they enacted what was called this preclearance provision of the act that these states had to submit their voting changes. The Supreme Court struck down that formula. So basically, there's no states that are now covered under the Voting Rights Act that have to approve their changes with the federal government.
Well, when states enact rules that require photo IDs, for example, does it matter whether they were covered by the Voting Rights, Section 4 of the old Voting Rights Act?
It did
Wisconsin,
matter.
For example, is not Texas, is not North Carolina. Wisconsin also has passed rules like that. It's not a southern state.
Yeah, so it purposefully never covered all the states, because to require every state in the country to approve their voting changes with the federal government would have been unconstitutional. So that provision survived. Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act survived for nearly 50 years because it was targeted at those states with the worst history of voting discrimination. Wisconsin doesn't have the same history as Texas or North Carolina or Alabama, so it didn't need to have to approve its voting changes with the federal government in the same way.
But wherever they're enacted, the proponents say that it will eliminate voter fraud, will prevent people from voting twice. And yet it has been pointed out again and again that is a very rare occurrence.
Well, there's really, really very little evidence of voter fraud. And I think this has really been a myth that's been debunked. There's been almost a billion votes cast since 2000, and there's only been 31 credible cases of voter impersonation. So to the extent that voter fraud exists in the American electoral system, it exists in absentee ballots. And absentee balloting is paradoxically often exempted from voter ID laws, which beg the question, are these laws really about protecting voter fraud? And if they were, why aren't they covering absentee ballots? Or are they about trying to make it harder for certain segments of the population to vote?
So when opponents argue that voter ID laws disenfranchise voters for other reasons, do the courts listen?
Well, there's been a mixed bag so far. Texas is a good example. Texas is a state where the voter ID law has been struck down twice as discriminatory. It was struck down in 2012 under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was then paralyzed by the Supreme Court decision in Shelby County versus Holder. And it was struck down again in September of this year under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which remains on the books. That decision was temporarily overturned by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and then stayed by the Supreme Court. So the voter ID law went into effect for the first time in the 2014 general election. And we saw, based on the lengthy record in both courts, but most recently the federal district court in Texas, that up to 600,000 registered voters in Texas don't have a government-issued ID, that it can be very difficult to access the underlying documents needed to get that ID. Those documents cost money, which is why the judge there called it an unconstitutional poll tax. And we've seen many reports of voters being turned away from the polls this election because they didn't have the right ID.
A number of states have passed new voting rules. North Dakota, Texas, Nebraska, Kansas, Wisconsin, Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Rhode Island, Indiana, Ohio, not just southern states. Are the laws pretty much all the same?
Yeah, I mean, what we saw after the 2012 election, the 2010 election, was that the same laws were being introduced in state after state after state. It seemed
all,
like there was a coordinated
effort.
With
Republican-controlled legislatures. So has this not been seen as a partisan issue?
I think it has been seen as a partisan issue. And the thing is that this was something that, you know, in response to the 2008 election, Republicans became a lot more concerned with tightening the voting rules, I think, to achieve a partisan advantage. They've been emboldened by the Supreme Court decision. States like Texas and North Carolina no longer have to approve their voting changes, so therefore they can enact more extreme legislation that's now harder to block. I think we're going to see more of this now that Republicans control more states after the 2014 election.
My guess is Ari Berman. We are talking about yesterday's elections and voting restrictions. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What happened in North Carolina? Have people been looking at the different states to see whether these voting rights restrictions are really had much of an impact?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at it right now and trying to sort through all the data and the different stories. And North Carolina is one of those states that passed a very sweeping 57-page bill with a lot of new voting restrictions after the Supreme Court Shelby County decision. Parts of that law, like the voter ID provision, have been delayed, but parts of it are now in effect, including cutting early voting by a week, eliminating same-day registration during the early voting period, and preventing out-of-precinct ballots from being counted. Now, those things seem to have an impact both in early voting and election day. There were reports of voters who would have normally been able to register during the early voting process who couldn't because same-day registration was eliminated. There were reports of voters being sent to the wrong precinct in the right county and then not having their votes counted anymore. There were longer lines on election day, potentially because early voting was cut in that state, so more people then voted during election day, which led to longer lines. This was a very close Senate race between Democrat Kay Hagan and Republican Tom Tillis, decided by about 50,000 votes, and many more voters were affected by those new voting restrictions. I'm not saying it swung the election, but I think it clearly had an impact.
Students can't vote on campus, and they can't use student ID as a voter ID. In many states, that was also enacted. At the same time, a gun permit would get you a voter ID.
Texas was the state that most famously allowed a concealed carry permit, but did not allow a state university ID as a valid form of voter ID. And we've seen a number of students turned away from the polls. I've heard reports of students in Houston, for example, showing up and not being able to vote. Yesterday in North Carolina, when I covered the hearing about the new voting law, I saw a sign that said, you know, government issued ID required to get in to the building. And I asked the security guards, could I get in with a state university ID? And they told me yes. But I can't vote with one if I'm a student in North Carolina, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Were polls being more closely monitored yesterday than they usually are?
Yeah, I think so. There were upwards of, I think, about 18,000 calls to the Election Protection Hotline, 866-OUR-VOTE. I was in two different call centers monitoring voting rights problems really all across the country yesterday. The phones were ringing off the hook. There's always general confusion on Election Day. Where is my polling place? Am I registered? Et cetera, et cetera. These new voting restrictions have added a whole nother layer of complexity, and you're trying to figure out, is this just election administration problems that happen every time, or are these nefarious efforts to prevent people from voting? It's hard to sift through the day after and know, but there definitely are disturbing reports of people being turned away either wrongly or as a result of these laws being passed.
There are also other kinds of problems that occur. My own experience yesterday was it turned out that my name was listed twice, one above the other with two different birthdays, but everything else exactly the same, my address, my name, and the people who were there were totally confused as to what to do about it. They wound up having me sign the wrong one, the one with the wrong birthday.
And the problem is that we have this very archaic election system where it really varies. Every polling place is different. Every county is different, and every state is different.
Brooklyn.
And this was in Brooklyn. And we're seeing also that a lot more voters are being told to cast provisional ballots now, which was something that was instituted after Florida 2000 to try to make sure that if you couldn't cast a regular ballot, you had an alternative. The problem is these provisional ballots are not being counted in large numbers. So you're having a lot of confusion on Election Day. If these were closer races, you could have seen a lot of litigation after this election.
Did these voting restrictions all get pushed through state legislatures after the Supreme Court decision?
No, not all of them. 21 states have new voting restrictions in place since the 2010 election, 14 of them for the first time in 2014. So certainly a number of states were allowed to enact new restrictions because of the Supreme Court decision. Not all of them, but a number of them.
Four voting rights cases have come to the Supreme Court this year, as you mentioned, Wisconsin, Texas, Ohio, North Carolina. In three of those cases, the court ruled in favor of the changes. But why do you think – well – first of all, why do you think the Roberts Court voted that way when the case has been made very strongly that it is meant to keep certain people from voting?
Well, the Roberts Court adopted what they viewed as a unified theory, which said basically that they didn't want any last-minute voting changes. So whether you were expanding early voting in Ohio or you were instituting voter ID in Wisconsin, if it happened right before the election, they weren't going to allow it. Now, the problem with that idea is it treated all voting changes at this like they were the same. So basically making it harder to vote was viewed as the functional equivalent of making it easier to vote, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense because if you enact a new voting restriction, that's a much greater barrier on a voter than if you, for example, allow more early voting time, which is something that can only help voters. These were not cases that were decided on the merits. So there's going to be these cases are going to go back to the Supreme Court, at least some of them, and there's going to be a full hearing. But the signs so far are distressing. The fact that the Supreme Court allowed voting restrictions in a state like Texas, where now on two different occasions after lengthy trials, the law has been blocked, and yet that law remains in effect, I think shows the weakness of the Voting Rights Act right now and the conservatism of the Roberts Court on this issue.
Justice Ginsburg offered a very critical dissent, saying that the court's ruling risks denying the right to vote to hundreds of thousands of eligible voters. And she was joined in the dissent by Justices Sotomayor and Kagan. I guess it's this is the female the male majority group in the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court blocked Wisconsin's voter ID law. Why did they diverge from the pattern that we'd seen so far?
Because the Wisconsin Court of Appeals approved that law so close to the election that the Supreme Court, acting under this theory that you shouldn't enact last-minute voting changes, blocked Wisconsin's voter ID law without ruling on the merits there. So that was a rare victory for voting rights. Justice Ginsburg has actually dissented in two cases, which is interesting because these are not, as I mentioned, full cases on the merits. These are only orders about what to do temporarily. But she clearly views these as a pretext, these rulings as pretext for larger votings that are going to restrict voting rights. That's why she dissented not only in the Texas case, but also in the North Carolina case. She basically said that these new voting restrictions that were approved temporarily by the Supreme Court would not have been in effect if the Supreme Court had not have gutted the Voting Rights Act. She famously dissented in that case, called it hubris at its worst. And this remains something that she's very, very concerned about. I think it's one of the reasons why she's not retiring, because she views this as an issue she really wants to care about and stay active on.
And Democrats say that these voting restrictions are very much aimed at them. I would assume that Republicans also weren't able to vote.
Yeah, I think they're aimed more certainly at Democrats. If you look at the core of the Democratic coalition, I mean, these new voting restrictions really have targeted young people, blacks, Hispanics, working class voters. I mean, those are kind of the core of the Democratic coalition. But certainly they've also hurt poor Republicans, elderly Republicans, to the extent that there are black or Hispanic Republicans. It's hurt them, too. So there is some collateral damage here. But I think the Republican Party still views these efforts as something that's going to benefit their party, at least in the short term. I don't know. It's not a very smart long term strategy to make it harder for people to vote, but certainly they believe they can get away with it for a few elections.
As a result of these new voting restrictions, there have been big get-out-the-vote campaigns to register voters to make sure that they have the IDs that they need. Have they ended up motivating people to vote? Because voter turnout, which is usually less for midterms, was not very good yesterday.
Yeah, I think the efforts were successful in 2012 when President Obama was on the ticket. They were not very successful in 2014. We saw in some states like North Carolina, there was higher turnout. I think there was the highest turnout ever for a midterm election there. That was in part because of an emphasis on get out the vote. But certainly, if you look at turnout across the country, it was 36.6% is the estimate I saw. That's the lowest voter turnout since 1940. So basically, you have a situation where almost twice as many voters, more than twice as many voters didn't vote as opposed to voted. And that's a very distressing situation.
In 2012, younger voters represented 19% of the electorate. But this year, only 13%.
It really is a tale of two electorates. The difference in the presidential elections of the last 2 years and the midterms of the elections in the last 2 years have been really, really striking. You just have a situation where the presidential elections are much younger, more diverse, and more progressive, and the midterm elections, at least in 2010 and 2014, have been a lot older, wider, and more conservative, and the Democratic base just is not turning out in very large numbers. The electorate was just so much older, in particular, this year than it was in years past.
In Colorado, turnout among Democrats was at a record low. In fact, the lowest for Senate races since 1992.
I think some of that is also frustration with the president on immigration. The fact that you have a very large Hispanic population in Colorado. President Obama deferred action on immigration reform until after the election, which was viewed as an effort to help some vulnerable Democrats. It certainly hurt Democratic candidate and Democratic incumbent Mark Udall in Colorado. Generally speaking, Hispanic turnout tends to be lower in midterm elections and was quite low this year. And that was a very big problem for Democrats in a number of states.
Hasn't the president been hit on immigration from both sides? I heard during news reports this morning that a number of people voted for Republicans because they felt that they would be stronger on immigration. Well, keep people out. They're very concerned about Ebola coming over from
Mexico. I was going to say, if you mean stronger as in deporting more people, I mean.
But this president has deported a lot of, I think, the most of any president we've ever had.
Well, and that's the problem for the president is that he deported all these people based on the theory that then he would be able to get congressional support for immigration reform. But he hasn't been able to get congressional support for immigration reform. And he has also delayed his executive action on this issue. So he really has satisfied neither constituency. He's both deported a lot of people and also not actually achieved anything real tangible on immigration. And that's why there's been a lower Hispanic turnout, while this issue continues to motivate the Republican base.
My guest is Ari Berman of The Nation. He is also an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He has been working on a book about voting rights since 1965. And we're talking about what happened yesterday during the midterm elections. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Ari Berman of The Nation. We're talking about what happened yesterday in terms of voting restrictions. Do you see this as a continuing trend? Do you expect voter restrictions in more states where Republicans are in power?
I do, because now Republicans control the greatest number of states since the 1920s, and we're seeing more states come under unified Republican control. I think Republicans now control 31 states, which is an extremely high number. So there are states, for example, like Nevada that are now under unified Republican control. I just heard that they're trying to make voter ID the top priority for the new Republican legislature there. So certainly, I mean, I think in any of these states where they flip from blue to red right now, there's a very good chance that you're going to see new voting restrictions get passed based on what's happened since 2010.
So now President Obama has the task of characterizing his party's losses, which came as a result of voter disapproval with his presidency. In 2010, he called it a shellacking. I don't know what he's going to say this year. Why do you think so many Democrats distance themselves from the president instead of running on an approved economy, lower unemployment, inexpensive gasoline prices, a health care system that, while less than perfect, can be improved and is approved by actually a slim majority of Americans? Instead, a few refused to even answer whether they had voted for him. And Allison Lindgren Grimes, who ran against Mitch McConnell, ran an ad about how she had opposed Obama. Do you think that if they had given a more positive tone to the campaign, they might have done better? Instead, they sounded like they were being defensive and the Republicans were on the attack.
Well, one of the problems for Democratic candidates was just the terrain this year was not very favorable to them. In the 34 states where Senate candidates were up for re-election, those states supported Romney over Obama. So, I mean, it was a very conservative playing field to begin with, and Democratic candidates had a difficult time in states like Kentucky or Arkansas. I mean, if they embrace the president, they're going to get roundly criticized. The voters in those states clearly didn't like the president. But then you had examples like Alison Grimes in Kentucky refusing to say she voted for Obama, which just made it seem worse. And she was completely blown out and didn't get the turnout she needed to even keep it close. So I think the Democrats could have had a more affirmative messaging. It's interesting if you look at, for example, some of the ballot initiatives that were up in 2014. The minimum wage was raised in a number of red states.
Marijuana
was legalized in certain places. Extreme abortion restrictions were defeated. So I think on the issues, a Democrat still hold an advantage. The economy was getting better, but no one talked about it. It was a little tough in the last few weeks of the election when all you saw in the news was either beheadings in places like Syria, or you saw just a constant drumbeat of Ebola hysteria, which made any sort of message almost impossible to break through.
In the past, Republicans had been hurt by some extreme remarks by some candidates, and they promised this time to cut down on them. But there were some extreme remarks made, and on both sides, actually. But the Republicans who made them, like Joni Ernst, still won. Gohmert, who is constantly being ridiculed, won by a big margin. In our own city, Michael Grimes, who was under indictment, I think, for 20 cases of fraud, won by a huge margin.
Well, the Republicans did do a better job of keeping some of the most extreme candidates from getting nominated this year as opposed to in prior years. It was also true that the media didn't seem that interested in looking into the views of people like Joni Ernst in Iowa. They gave her Democratic opponent, Bruce Brilley, an incredibly difficult time. There was this whole spat about whether he was going to sue his neighbor over chickens, which was kind of a manufactured crisis to begin with. There were some things that he said that made it more difficult for him, like he suggested that Chuck Grassley, the senior senator from Iowa, shouldn't be chair of the judiciary because he's not a lawyer. He's a farmer. Grassley is a quirky but beloved figure in Iowa politics. So these were things that kind of dominated the campaign in the state as opposed to really looking into Ernst, who I think if you look at the issues that she believes in, you look at the issues that Iowa voters believe in, there's really a huge gap there. So it's going to be really interesting to see how someone like her, who is very, very conservative, represents a state like Iowa, which is relatively moderate for the next 6 years.
But in Kansas, some leading Republicans opposed the Republican governor, Sam Brownback, because they felt that he had ruined the economy. Many people seemed to feel that way, and yet he won.
I think at the end of the day, the anti-Obama sentiment prevailed.
What did that have to do with the governor's race?
But I think it did, though. I think at the end of the day, in states like Kansas, because there was also a contested Senate race there, that the kind of specter of the Obama presidency loomed over everything. Kansas is also an extremely conservative state. So even if there's a backlash among some moderate Republicans against what Governor Brownback and some of the other Republicans are doing there, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's enough to get them voted out of office. And that was really, I think, even more than retaking the Senate, the fact that Republicans held so many governor's races and actually were able to win in states like Illinois and Maryland was probably the brightest spot for the party in the yesterday.
Massachusetts, the governor's race went to the Republican. It's considered one of the solidest blue states in the country. In fact, I think it's the only state that went from a govern in his election against Richard Nixon.
And Massachusetts has something of a history of voting for Republican governors, though. You think of Bill Weld, for example, who I think was governor of Massachusetts for 8 years. But it's certainly true that Republicans were able to win in a number of very blue states, while Democrats weren't able to win in nearly any red states. And I think that's very, very problematic for the Democratic Party. They got to figure out a way to invest in these states beyond just parachuting in an election time, running a bunch of TV ads, and then leaving when it's over.
Mitch McConnell gave a speech yesterday in which he said that even though he's going to continue to disagree with the president, he's going to look for ways to come up with areas of agreement. But isn't he going to have his own problems? Ted Cruz refused to say whether he would support Mitch McConnell for majority leader.
Well, Mitch McConnell's essentially devoted his recent Senate career to opposing the president. So I don't think anyone believes that they're suddenly going to come together and start singing Kumbaya. In terms of Ted Cruz, I mean, there are a number of senators, I'd say probably half their Senate Republican caucus, that now has presidential aspirations. And they're going to at times make life difficult for the new Senate majority leader. McConnell's lucky that he won so many races, that now he has a larger majority. He doesn't have a 51-vote majority. He has a 54, 55-vote majority, potentially.
But not 60.
But he can refuse to lose some senators. But he doesn't have 60, so there still will be a Democratic filibuster, potentially. This is going to be another issue, I think, about what to do with filibuster. I imagine that there's going to be an extreme level of rancor here. I don't think anything is going to get done. I think there's going to be a lot of fights. There's already going to be fights about funding the government like there were in the past few years. And so I think it's going to be a very contentious relationship between the president and Senate Majority Leader McConnell.
And it's assumed that the Senate will vote to defund Obamacare or to change it, despite the fact that polls indicated that this was yesterday, exit polls, 48% thought that the law was about right or didn't go far enough, and 47% thought that the law went too far, which means that a majority prefer Obamacare, despite the fact that we're going to probably see many votes in the House and the Senate defunding it again.
Well, this is such a big issue for the Republican base. They're so riled up about this law that they're not going to stop until they've at least voted more than 40 times to defund it. They've already voted 40 times, so I don't know how many more times they can try to do this. They can try to sneak it into budget bills that the president's going to need to sign. I still don't think he will capitulate on this issue. One of the sad things that happened as a result of this election is that the fact that Republican governors were reelected in states like Florida meant that there won't be Medicaid expansion. Remember, the Supreme Court decision that upheld Obamacare said to states that they could decline expanding Medicare, which is one of the main ways to be able to cover people. Actually, I should say expand Medicaid. And so there's going to be millions of Americans that don't have health care as a result of this election.
Now, during the primaries, many people argued that the Tea Party had lost its clout. But there are still many Tea Party members of Congress. And as I said, Ted Cruz said he's not sure that he will even support Mitch McConnell for majority leader. So do you expect the Tea Party obstruction within the Republican Party to continue?
Yes, because I think that even though Tea Party candidates aren't necessarily winning primaries, they lost, for example, a very high-profile Republican primary in Mississippi, they've institutionalized themselves into the party to the point where Republican senators are just afraid to take them on. And there's candidates like Joni Ernst in Iowa, who we talked about earlier, who aren't quote-unquote Tea Party candidates. They have establishment support, but they basically have the same views as the Tea Party. And so I don't really see a huge disparity between an establishment Republican like Mitch McConnell and even a Tea Party candidate like Ted Cruz. I think, generally speaking, the Republican Party is very, very conservative right now. Most of the moderates have been pushed out, and it's really a question of tone and emphasis as opposed to a real difference in ideology at this point.
It's been pointed out that voter ID laws and gerrymandering have tipped the balance for Republicans for the time being. Is that the way it's going to be for a long time? If you have a permanent Republican majority in many state houses, there's a little opportunity to un-gerrymander or re-gerrymander in another direction.
Well, with gerrymandering, we're in a situation
where— Should we say
where,
gerrymandering? There's at least one listener who will point out that his name was actually Gary.
Yes, it's true, but I think we're safe with gerrymander for now. I mean, the Congress has something like a 10% approval rating. I mean, you'd think any institution with a 10% approval rating, nearly every member of it would be at risk of losing their jobs. But paradoxically, there was only about 11 or 12 contested races in the whole country. And so you had a situation where, despite the unpopularity of Congress, nearly every member of Congress was reelected, regardless of their party. And Republicans in Congress, who are the most unpopular, were able to actually pick up seats in the House. So gerrymandering, I think, is a major problem. These voter ID laws have the potential for there to be a backlash against them. But it's hard to organize a backlash in a non-presidential year. So I think you're seeing the impact of them on these off-year elections. Now, in 2016, there could be a larger turnout. People could be motivated. But certainly we're not in a situation now where these efforts to make it harder to vote could succeed. And I think in some cases are succeeding.
I've seen a number of liberal pundits, licking their wounds and saying, well, all this means is that that in the next presidential election, a Democrat's going to be elected and Congress is going to go to the Democrats, that this may be a good thing for the Democrats. But isn't that the same sort of thing that the Spartacists said in Germany when Hitler came to power?
Well, I think there's two problems with
I don't mean to compare the Republicans with Hitler. Yeah. What I'm trying to say is that whenever a a group is really drubbed, they always say, well, this just means that we're going to do better next time because the group that has taken over is going to really mess up.
Well, one of the problems is just that Republicans won so many seats, it's going to be harder for Democrats to take over the Senate. The second thing is, let's say Hillary Clinton runs in 2016. Is the most unpopular figure going to be the Republican Congress, or will the Republican Congress make President Obama even more unpopular? So we don't quite know how this is going to play out. I would generally say that this is good news for the Democratic presidential candidates because they'll have something to run against. Because if they don't want to run with President Obama and be a third Obama term, they can at least say, I'm running against Ted Cruz and all those crazy Republicans in Congress.
Well, does it depend on how well the next 2 years go for Republicans? We have a lame duck president. This is almost seems to be a prescription for gridlock. On the other hand, Republicans may very well realize that unless they do something and finally get some things enacted, they are going to be blamed for it.
I would wager a lot of money that the obstruction will continue, that I don't think Republicans can help themselves at this point. The hatred for President Obama is so great that I think that there's going to be a lot of confrontation, a lot of gridlock. Voters were very unhappy with the last budget battles, the shutting down of the government, the debt ceiling fiasco. All of this stuff is now going to return, and I think it's going to sour voters on both parties. And now Republicans are in control of the entire Congress, so they're going to bear some responsibility for this. You're talking about a 2016 election that's going to be on more favorable Democratic terrain. So I think the Republicans will overreach and will be blamed for it. I don't necessarily know how that's going to play out with what President Obama does, but I think they're going to be on perilous terrain for the next 2 years as well.
Right now, we're already seeing people coming up with the potential presidential candidates on both parties, but especially the Republican Party, Scott Walker, Ted Cruz. None of them strike me as having the kind of appeal, a national appeal, that could win the presidency for them. Do the Democrats have anybody better? I know most people are saying Hillary Clinton. A few on the left are saying Elizabeth Warren, but there's practically no one else.
The problem for the Democrats is they don't have anyone other than Hillary. So there's really no alternative here. And she's probably going to run, but we don't know what she's going to do, and we don't know how she's going to position herself. There's a lot of unease about the economy right now, but economic inequality, how is she going to position herself on that issue? And then with the Republicans, I think some of these Republican governors like John Kasich of Ohio, who were reelected, they're at least going to start thinking about running. Whether they'll win and run is a whole other story.
And then there's always Chris Christie. Ari Berman is a contributing writer for The Nation, investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. When can we expect your book to come out?
Next summer.
Thank you so much for being on our show again. It's
Thank
been
you,
a real
Leonard.
Pleasure having you here.
I really appreciate it.